Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is the BBC.
Hiya, thanks for downloading the show. My name is Susan Kalman. I'm a comedian and this is my podcast, Mrs. Brightside, a cheerful take on depression. Yes, comedy and depression, bit of a weird one, isn't it? Thing is, I like to make misery funny and I think other people feel the same way. And I wanted to make this podcast because I think we should all talk more about our mental health and remove some of the stigma surrounding it. I've invited 8 amusing people into a basement in Soho to bare their souls to me. I didn't have any questions. It's not a traditional interview. I just wanted to chat to them about what they thought about their own heads. There's no parameters. There's no definitions. It's just coming from them and me. In this episode, I talked to comedian Jordan Brooks, and it really was one of those fascinating chats I've had in my life.
I didn't have a great adolescence, not that should be a surprise to anyone.
I can tell you, in all these 8 podcasts, I don't think any of us had a good... I think not having a good adolescence is not singling you out there, Jordan. I think we're all miserable when we're adolescents, yeah. I'd never met Jordan before, and from the very beginning, he was unexpected, he was startling, and it really... I could have talked to him for hours. Unfortunately, you only get about 50 minutes, but it is absolutely fascinating. Trapped in a cupboard with someone I've never met before. This is the best way to start a depression podcast ever. Hello, my name is Susan Kalman, and I have depression. I'm a comedian. Please introduce yourself to the listening audience.
My name is Jordan Brooks. I don't currently feel depressed, but, you know...
There's always time, Jordan.
Hey, there's always time. Yeah, we always sit on that spectrum, just whizzing up and down it all day.
Yep.
Yeah.
Comedian.
I guess.
Successful.
Mm-hmm.
Nominated for... Did you win? Nominated?
I feel like I won, but I didn't know.
I feel like I win Edinburgh every time I go there. For the most 3-star reviews possible.
That's the best way to approach Edinburgh, I think.
This podcast has a huge balloon above it of mental health, which can be numerous things. Personally, I have depression and anxiety, which is pretty cool.
Well, nice.
What's your bag, Jordan? It's so cool talking to someone on a mental health podcast just going, so what's wrong with you then?
Yeah, go on then.
Yeah, go on. Impress us. What's wrong with you?
Disembowel yourself for it, please.
What have you got?
I've sort of sat on a sort of spectrum of depression and anxiety, I guess, broadly speaking, as most people tend to. But more specifically, I have an obsessive compulsive disorder called pure OCD, which is not defined by the sort of traditional rituals that you would associate with OCD, as in having to do things a certain number of times or worrying that you've left the oven on, etc. And it's more to do with internal rituals, so thinking, thought processes. It's defined by intrusive thoughts, essentially. And obviously, we all experience those to some extent, but pure OCD is defined by what we do with those thoughts and how that impacts on our life. And so, it's sort of I guess it's that in the same way that with a sort of more physical manifestation of OCD, it's just internalized, so that you're assessing something over and over and over again. You're turning it over. You're worrying. It's all related to doubt, and that sense of doubt that you have, that you can't quite find the thing that assures you that this isn't real, or this isn't okay, or this is okay rather. So that's that.
The reason I'm looking at you with this look on my face, Jordan, is I feel
I may have discovered something I had I didn't know. Please explain to me further about this.
Here we go. Okay.
Okay, here we go. Here's a nice sideline in this podcast. I may have a different form of mental health issues than I thought.
Yeah, so this is interesting. You're not the first person to say this. And the reason why, this is I mean, maybe we'll come to this, but this is part of the reason why I'm willing to talk about this sort of stuff is because it is lesser known and actually perversely widespread for how little is known about it and for what few options there are for people to actually get treatment. So yeah, it's intrusive thoughts. So if you have like it's often like sorry to make a literary reference so quickly, but
no, please do, Jordan.
So Edgar Allan Poe.
Why did you say that? Like I don't read books or something, Jordan.
I don't know. I just didn't want you to be like, oh, he's been reading this. He's been brushing up on his Edgar Allan Poe this morning. I know he's been scouting for quotes. He wrote a story called The Imp of the Perverse, mm-hmm. and it's essentially about that. It's about this seemingly outside force that comes in and floods your head with thoughts that are the most like they're completely against what you would want to think, and that is, you know, that is something that everyone experiences, you mm-hmm. know, whether it's just simply thinking about jumping in front of a train as it heads into the station, or thinking about pushing someone else into or jumping off a cliff. You know, these things, we have that thought because it's the most perverse thing you could think of, mm-hmm. and often your brain will go there. Now, for someone who experiences pure OCD, but it's anxiety. It's all connected. It's all related to each other. Mm-hmm. It all sits in the same sort of ballpark. It's how you process that thought. So if you have a thought which is like, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how specific I want to be with my own experiences, but maybe in a bit. But for example, you might be talking to somebody who it would be absolutely inappropriate for you to get off with them. Like, you know, out of nowhere. Now, you might have that impulse, that thought. Yes. Now, everyone has that. Everyone has that little instinct, and you're like, where did that go? But we all have this stream of thoughts going past every day, you know, these of varying levels of intensity and perversity. But it's what your brain does once that thought has manifested. So for most people, they just dismiss it as a passing thought. For others, it's a cause for serious alarm, and they'll go, why did that thought occur to me? Mm-hmm. What does that say about me as a person? Mm-hmm. And so if you're thinking about, you know, killing someone, or you have the instinct, if you're you know, you're holding a knife and you're, you know, chopping up vegetables with someone in the kitchen, and you think, what if I just rammed it into their face right now? And you go, why did that occur mm-hmm. to me? Am I a psychopath? So it makes you doubt your sense of who you are, and you cannot, no matter how much oxygen you give it, no matter how much you ruminate on it and turn it over and over and over, you cannot find that reassuring thought that allows you to close the door on it. It never goes.
It's not something that makes you act on the impulses, but it's the thoughts that come in.
Yeah.
It's a thing that fascinates me about speaking to people with broad strokes mental health issues is how much our minds work. I'm not saying that we are Professor X. But sometimes I'll be sitting on the sofa with my wife and I'll say, what are you thinking? And she'll say nothing, literally nothing.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a point in my life where I think about nothing. There's a single moment in my life where I'm not thinking about something.
I think when she says nothing, she just means nothing she can broadcast.
No, genuinely. My wife was popular at school, had a lovely time, is kind and she has some foibles, but is generally fine.
Yeah.
Like, literally, generally fine. And I sit on the sofa with her, going, "She's not spoken to me for 5 minutes. Why has she not spoken to me?" And she's watching the television.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Well, clearly there's something wrong, and she's not talked to me about it. Why has she not talked to me about it?" And so when I say, "What are you thinking about?" and she says nothing, I go, "Well, that's fine then. You're lying to me." She's genuinely watching Antiques Roadshow.
But it's probably what she defines as nothing is what other people define as a lot. So it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's all passing through us. It's all going through us. This constant stream of random thoughts. But it's how much you actually let it pass. And that was something I learned a few years ago when I was sort of trying to. Because early on in my early 20s, it was the worst it has been. And I genuinely was frightened, absolutely petrified, and I didn't think I would get out of that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was, and there was no obvious answer. And I would go to the doctors and I'd say, this is what's happening, and I have these bizarre impulsive intrusive thoughts, and it's not what I want to think, but I can't shake it off. And they would just go, it's anxiety, it's stress. And I would go, okay, well, that's nice and reassuring for half an hour, but then that doesn't stop the rituals, that doesn't stop the constant checking, the constant sort of, do I still think that, what do I feel, you know. When I talk about intrusive thoughts, I mean, we're talking like from violent to sexual, to even something as sort of quite gentle as looking at your partner and thinking, do I love you? Like, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes we have that. We just look at someone and you go, oh, I don't feel the thing that I think I should feel right now. And then you worry. And so I've experienced a manner of different things. And each one has dominated various stages of my life. But it's, when I didn't know what it was, that was the worst period of my life for sure. And so, I think it's important to talk about this stuff, and I never thought it would be, because I've always been of the mind that, like, everyone experiences depressive thoughts, everyone experiences anxiety. We are anxious because, by mere virtue of the fact that we exist, it mm-hmm. is frightening to be alive, and that is anxiety.
Yeah.
So we are anxiety, and so to go, I have depression, I have anxiety, is great for the individual, but I wonder how helpful that is for other people who see it as a category that perhaps they can't subscribe to. So I've always been a bit sorry, this is a very sort of all over the place conversation, but I've always been of the mind that don't give it a label, particularly on stage, because you want people to relate to it as much as possible. And for a lot of people, they wouldn't associate, as you said at the start, you didn't realize that intrusive thoughts might be a thing.
Yes.
But for me to go, I have pure OCD and this is what it is, mm-hmm. that risks making people go, well, that's probably not me because I don't have a thing, you know, because there's still a lot of stigma attached to mental health. But if you go, so what I'll do on stage is I'll say, do you ever have this thought, or does this ever mm-hmm. occur to you? And mm-hmm. most people will go, shit, yeah, wow. Yeah. And then later on you can go, by the way, in case you're worried about this thing, mm-hmm. there is a label for it. And if it is ruining, if it is impacting on the quality of your life, then there are options available to you.
When talking about mental health issues, and I've done shows about it and written a book about it and radio shows about it, there are so many things. When you're writing a comedy show anyway, you think about the structure. Mm. So you think about, if someone comes to see me and they don't know who I am, how am I going to introduce myself? All those kind of things, right? Yeah. But then you've got the added thing of, if you're going to talk about something like this, terminology is fascinating.
Mm.
You know, I said in my book that if I say I self-harmed, that's difficult to saying I was a cutter.
Mm-hmm.
Because those two things have very different...
very different connotations.
Visceral reactions in an audience.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to get people to take notice, you say you're a cutter.
Mm.
Or you say self-harm.
Mm.
And so the thing I found fascinating about writing comedy about these issues, and or writing about it in general, is there are so many layers. There's the... not the stigma, because I think the more we talk about it, the less the stigma exists. So I think in general it's a good thing.
That. Yeah.
But then it's, how do I want to tell people about my thing?
Mm.
How do I want to put that out there for people?
Yeah, and I think when, and this isn't, I there is no easy way of doing it. So, but when people go, I have depression, I think there's a curious distancing for others, and I don't know why that is, and I don't know if that's just because maybe we're all sick of hearing about it, or we're all sort of like, well, we all have our own things and we don't want to, you know, and how dare you give it a specific concrete label.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think it is important to talk about this stuff out loud, and certainly in regards to less commonly known but very subtly widespread stuff like sort of intrusive thoughts.
So when did you start thinking, when did you know this was happening? I've been depressed for as long as I can remember.
Yeah, I mean, I was a depressive child. Like, I remember my parents divorced when I was 10, and I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. And I've never not been miserable since then. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in varying levels, and that's not to say I haven't had happy periods in my life. But I was a depressed child, and I didn't know. I don't think my parents realized. But I was also very obsessional very early on. You know, I would latch onto one thing, much like a lot of kids do. You latch onto one thing and you live in that thing for as long as you can. And then you get bored and you go to the next thing and you live in that thing. And whether it be, you know, Ghostbusters or doing magic tricks or something, it's just, you know, but it would be borderline obsessional. Mm-hmm. And then when I hit adolescence, I didn't have a great adolescence. Not that should be a surprise to anyone.
I can tell you, in all these 8 podcasts, I don't think any of us had a good. I think not having a good adolescence is not singling you out there, Jordan. I think we're all miserable when we're adolescents. Yeah.
So I became very obsessed with various things, like the way I looked. I really believed that I was like distinctively ugly. Like I really believed it growing up, and I would look at my face in the mirror for hours, and I would take the mirror out into the garden and look at myself in natural light, and I don't know what I was looking for, but I just couldn't stop looking. I was like trying to decide. It was almost like trying to decide, am I attractive? Am I, you know? And I just couldn't, and I couldn't leave it alone. I'd look in the mirror, then I'd sit back down, and I'd be like, I've got to look again, and I'd go back, and I'd bad skin, so I'd be counting my spots and over again, you know? And it was stuff like that where I was like, this seems like an odd thing for me to be doing, but also there's no one around to tell me that this isn't normal. Mm-hmm. So and then when I hit about 2021, I became very obsessed with, I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to be creative. And I'm like, you know, some undiscovered genius, and I'm going to do nothing but read Will Self and write short stories into the early hours of the night. And then, I became so obsessed that I wasn't doing anything productive, but I was thinking about it the whole time. Mm-hmm. So I'd be flitting from like, I'd be like, oh, I feel a bit undernourished intellectually, so I'll read a book. And then I'd sit down and I'd read 2 lines of a book and be like, oh, no, I should just be doing some writing. And then I'd go and do some writing. And then I'd write 2 sentences and be like, no, I should probably do some exercise. Exercise is good. It releases endorphins. You know, so I'd just be flitting day after day after day. And I was living with my parents. I didn't want to go to university. I didn't go to university until about 24. So this was sort of before that. I didn't have a job. I was so desperately insecure. And I was just like, I'm going to be a creative genius hermit who lives with his parents in Dorset. And, you know, but I was.
One day
I was,
they will write films.
Yeah,
about
exactly. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Maybe they'll skip past this bit, but like, whatever good thing will happens at the end of this as a result of this. So I just worked myself up into a state, and I would go to sleep every night going over and over and over, trying to assure myself that I had done something productive that day. And I was basically like talking to myself like it wasn't me. Like I'd be going, you did this, you did this, you did this, don't worry about this, you did this, you did this. And it just was relentless. I could not, no matter how much I tried to assure myself, no matter what arguments I presented to myself, I just could not feel satisfied. And that then manifested in, it became more concrete in my early 20s, about 2021. And I became obsessed that I was a paedophile. I really worried that I was a paedophile, apropos of nothing. I just had the thought, mm-hmm. and then I couldn't shake it off. And I was absolutely, you know, I was horrified. And I go to the doctors, and the doctors were like, you wouldn't be worrying. Mm-hmm. And, but that wasn't enough to reassure me. And, it became like an obsession, and then I'd worry about, like, you know, just inappropriate things, like whether I was gonna, you know, sexually assault my mum and stuff, and you know, I'd be like looking at her and I'd think, what do I feel? I just became incredibly doubtful of who I was, mm-hmm. and I felt like an alien in my own body, and for about 5-6 years, it ruined my life, and I can't believe that I'm in this position where I'm able to reflect back on it, mm-hmm. from such a distance, because when I was in it, I really didn't think I was going to get out. And when I'd go to the doctors and they'd say, they just didn't know what it was. And I didn't know what it was. And I went to a therapist, and the therapist was like, this is nothing, and everyone experiences, we didn't say nothing, but you know, the general vibe was, this isn't anything to worry about. We all sit on a scale of anxiety and depression. It manifests itself differently, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like, look at the landscape of your life, and this is just one of many things. But I'm like, yeah, but...
But it's really worrying me.
Yeah, but exactly. Really worrying me. Yeah, but the horizon is on fire. Like, I can't ignore the fact that I'm getting smoke inhalation from all this awfulness. And then, what did I do? Because I was living with my parents. I didn't have many friends or anything. And it was actually that feeling, all of that stuff manifesting actually made me feel really unsafe on my own. I suddenly didn't enjoy my own company. I suddenly wasn't this you know, crazed, creative genius who could just get on with it and write some opus. I was like, oh, I've got to get out of this house because I don't like my own company anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was actually what motivated me then to go to university. Now, I'm not glad that you know, of my mental health issues, but it certainly was a strong motivator to actually get out and just be like, you've got to do something. You've got to get out and embrace life and meet other people. And so I slowly sort of built a life that, you know, I just sort of dealt with it day to day, but it was a constant. It's a constant. And you know it's there. And it's in those quiet moments that's where your brain always returns to. Mm-hmm. And you never satisfy it. And I would have these really bad periods, but I would still be functioning, you know, on the surface. And then I tried antidepressants. They didn't really work. And then I think one night I was just Googling. I was just looking because I was like, I've got to fuck. This has got to be something. And I was searching for like intrusive thoughts and all this stuff. And eventually it led me to hearing about Pure OCD. And I remember finding a message board where it was various sort of, you know, obsessive compulsive disorders. But there was one where it was like a, you know, subcategory of sort of, I can't remember what it was at the time, but like sexual one, I think. And each thread title on the message board was like every thought that I had had, where it was someone writing, I don't know how to cope with this, I can't do this anymore, this is ruining my life, all this stuff, like often written in like block capitals, completely panicky, people losing their minds.
Yeah.
And I remember reading those and like laughing and crying at the same time, because I couldn't believe that I was seeing this. I couldn't believe that people had experienced the same thing and that it was a thing. And that was a huge revelation for me. And suddenly I was reading books about it and understanding it better. And then that led me to being on the right kind of medication, which they do use for the treatment of OCD, which has helped immeasurably. I've been on that for about 4 years. And
so in the case of that, there is a course of treatment. It's just a case of getting the diagnosis of what it actually is.
Yeah, so it's raising awareness of it, because most doctors did not know what it was. A lot of therapists do. A lot of therapists do. But not all of them do. But there are specialists in it now. There are specialists. But yeah, there are treatment options. But it's that feeling of, as I'm sure you've felt when you go to the doctors and they can't help you, and you've been sort of going, well, if I go to the doctors, that will be fine. That will be the solution. I'll get the thing that will make all of this okay. Mm-hmm. And when that doesn't come, the feeling of being alone is unmanageable.
I think the act of seeking help is a very interesting one. Mm. And a lot of people have been put off by their first attempts.
Mm.
So, and it's absolutely not the fault of GPs. But no. GPs have, 5 minutes to see every patient. So if you actually get up the courage to go to see a GP, you've got 5 minutes. Mm. I still can't talk about some of the things that make me depressed after 43 years in an hour.
Of course, yeah.
Never mind sitting with a stranger and someone going, so what's wrong?
In 10 minutes, well, okay, I'll give you the abridged version of my trauma.
I sit at night and I hate myself so much I want to kill myself.
Yeah.
Oh, Miss Kalman, that sounds absolutely fine.
That's also, I've got a rash on my thigh. Could you have a look at that as well?
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
And then the referral rate for NHS therapists, again, waiting lists.
Crazy long.
All of those kind of things. And if somebody feels, I always think, if someone feels compelled to go to their GP for help, they need help. Because to get to that stage where you go there, you know, because most of us sit and suffer in silence for a good year or so before you think, shit, I'm in trouble here, I need to go and see someone.
That's it, yeah. People don't recognise the early indications that something needs to be dealt with. Because yeah. also, again, that's partly down to stigma, partly down to a stigma attached to antidepressants as well. You know, I still think people think, you know, a lot of friends of mine have been hesitant to go on them because they're
it's
like...
It's a very controversial subject, antidepressants.
It really is, yeah.
I've never taken them.
Mm.
Because in my... This is simply my view. Mm-hmm. The cause of my depression is self-confidence, all of that stuff, which I need to work on. I need to work on a CBT, cognitive behavioural thing
yeah.
to stop myself thinking I'm so awful at everything. I need to sort that out.
Yeah.
And for me, taking a pill would not have helped that part of it.
Because there are things that you can identify externally.
There are things I can do to make myself feel better.
100%, yeah. And so with OCD, it's essentially there is no cure. There is no end to it. There is no solution. It's just about management. And that was a really hard thing to realize, is that it is an ongoing thing, and it will most likely manifest itself in various ways for the rest of my life. And what the... So there's a sort of science behind it with this is related to anxiety as well, is that we lack a certain chemical, and that is what gives us that sense. We need to ruminate, because that actually generates the chemical. And so taking I think they are used in the treatment of depression as well, but whatever you want to call them, they give me that chemical. So I don't ruminate. I still have these intrusive thoughts. I still have these panicky moments.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's no, in no way am I dulled or numbed by them. But what it does is it stops me from getting caught in these cycles of rumination. Now that might be something that I can deal with externally. Ideally, I don't be on them forever, but I also need to accept that I might have to be.
I think the thing is about mental health is it's a broad term, you know, and there is no cure for mental health. What there is a number of different things which will assist. So for me, I went to a bit of CBT, I changed my life, started exercising, stopped drinking so much, you know, lots of things which has assisted. And sometimes it can take a long time. I mean, you're saying for yourself that took a long time before you found out what it was and found the treatment.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're talking it's been 10, 11 years since it's sort of flared up. And, you know, I've only lived half of that relatively well, so yeah, it takes a long time,
and to find the solution. So that's why when people talk about antidepressants, and I've not taken them, friends of mine have, and it's really helped them.
Yeah,
and I think anyone who suggests that they have the ultimate advice for someone with any form of mental health condition, they don't.
No, absolutely,
have that, because it's a very personal thing. It's your circumstances. It's how accepting you are of your own condition as well.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to admit how bad or good it is at a particular time.
Yeah. And for me, it's just, it's a choice between, do I live a relatively normal quality of life, or do I sink into a hole? And I've tried everything to not, but it's impossible, because it's essentially what it is. It's a feeling of doubt and of not being able to quite scratch that itch. And it's that feeling of, yeah, but what if this is true? What if? And you, no matter how many arguments you present to try and like quell this doubt, it doesn't work. Your brain will always find a new way of going, yeah, but what about this? When you were this age and this happened, now this all makes sense. And it's suddenly like it's creating a new timeline.
Yes.
And so the meds for me stop that, which means I don't get caught up in my own head. And, you know, I was a nightmare to be in a relationship with. I know that before I went on the meds. I would just go into myself and I would just not be there. Because I'd be so trapped, and it makes you angry, and it makes you frustrated because you don't feel like you're living a life, and it's really hard to be around that.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely changed me for the better in terms of being, just being a person, just being able to be a person.
I think the anger at myself because I'm depressed is the worst anger.
Yeah,
and it frustrates my wife most of all.
I'm sure.
Because then I get angry about being depressed.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And I'm like, why am I like this?
Why
I ended up in this situation?
Yeah.
Which she points out is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is unnecessary at that point, quite frankly, when I'm having a tantrum. But it makes it, the anger's a really difficult part of depression. People think depression is about sitting
crying in the dark.
And, it's not. Yeah, depression's about anger as well. Depression's can be a loud, violent, and I don't mean punching someone, but internally violent struggle.
Oh, absolutely. And that's down to a misconception of mental illness and what we perceive it to be. And so that's why I've always been on the fence about whether to give things a label when talking about stuff, because I want people to feel like it is not a thing that you have that needs to be, as you say, there's a solution for or that needs to be cured. Actually, it isn't. It's about management.
Yeah.
It's about finding the thing, the system that works for you to allow you to live the best possible life you can.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is making sure that it's not a thing that is separate, that is external. And so if I'm talking about it on stage, I talk about it matter-of-factly because, as far as I'm concerned, it is a matter-of-fact part of most people's everyday existence. And in that way, you sort of destigmatize it, I think. But I'm not 100% on how I feel about what I've just said. It feels like it might be I think that's the right way to do it.
Let's talk about it because I've struggled with what the purpose is of me being on stage and saying to people I'm depressed.
Yeah.
Part of it is needy. I'm depressed, love me. Part of it's that, no doubt. Part of it is a very worthy part where I'm wanting to destigmatize mental health.
Yeah.
Part of it is because I know I can get laughs in a way other people can't. Because I know the strangeness of my own behaviour is ultimately a funny thing.
Yeah, it's funny because it's exposing something that I think the majority of us experience, and when someone comes up and goes, "This is what I have experienced," everyone goes, "Oh, thank you for doing that, for saying that." In a way, it's a taboo. Isn't that what comedy or the best kind of comedy challenges that boundary? And this is why I get very frustrated when there's like these sort of self-styled provocateurs who are sort of attacking. And it was always people that are disadvantaged to themselves, societally speaking.
Yes.
Whereas actually to push boundaries is to challenge people's thinking in other ways. And it's not just like saying something about Muslims, it's talking about mental health. It's that is challenging. That is the thing that we want to see.
I think creatively, the thing about depression and mental health is just a subject like any other it's the same as what's the difference between men and women. It's a subject that we write about as comedians. I think what I like creatively about it is that your experience of mental health and my experience of mental health are different but similar.
Yeah,
there is a connection.
Yeah.
But my own quirks and foibles that I've developed, my coping strategies that I've developed through time, are different to yours.
Yeah.
So one of the good things is lots of us write about depression and do shows about depression. They're not the same because we're all mental in different ways.
Absolutely, yeah.
Felicity Ward and I could have a show in the same venue, an hour apart, about depression, and they will be completely different because her experience is different to mine. And it sounds very strange, but having mental health problems is a brilliant thing creatively. I think it is. It's a good thing. I think it makes us think about things slightly differently.
Well, I find that the common thread that bounds all of the people that are closest to me in my life is that they have at some point been broken.
Yes.
And they have been given they've had to reflect on themselves, and they've had to, you know, assess where they're at. Absolutely, it does help. Yeah, of course it does. Because absolutely it does. But I also know that it's like, it's finding ways of making that funny. It's such a great challenge. It's about, how can I make people laugh despite themselves? How can I say something that is so inappropriate or so like outlandish or unsaid, and make people go, I can't believe you've structured that in a way that makes me, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That to me is a really great challenge.
Comedy, I quite like horror films.
Mm.
Less than I used to, because the world is falling apart. And
we live in
I one. Used to love horror films, and now I just look at the news. But the structure of tension and release is very
same.
Similar. Mm. It's a very similar thing. And I do find creatively thinking about an argument I've had with my wife because I've been anxious. A stupid argument. In a previous show, I talked about the fact that she will not let me be president of the United States.
What?
So we watched The West Wing. I said I wanted to be president of the United States. In that way that you do, you know, darling, what would you like to do?
Yeah.
Your life. And she said I couldn't because I wasn't born in America. And I was like, but we're just having a chat. Yeah. Let's just chat. Could you just leave it?
Could you just leave it?
But she's a lawyer, and sometimes she's far too lawyerly, and she's thinking about the actual argument in court.
Yeah.
And so you're thinking about, it was actually a genuine argument. It was a genuine argument where I was like, why are you being a dick? Will you stop being a dick? And then you can turn it into a story. And I like looking at the darkest things in my life and thinking about how I can make them palatable and funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a beautiful challenge, I think.
It's great. It's so great. And to have, you know, I've done three full-length shows now, and this was the only one where I've actually actively given things a label. It's always been a common strand within it. It's, I've always wanted, my sort of guiding aim, if I had one, was do like broad existential observational comedy. Mm-hmm. So make it as accessible as possible, but talk about really niche, dark stuff. And that has always been my sort of guiding challenge. But this was the first show where I leaned into it a bit more because it was relevant to the show. But what it did was it made people came up to me afterwards and they'd go, and as I've never had this reaction before, like I'm not sure how comfortable I felt about it, but people would come up to me and go, I've had exactly the same thing. I'm so glad. Like, people came up to me in tears as well and being like, I didn't expect that to come up. I've experienced that, or my brother's experienced that. And that made me feel like it was perfect. It was for the first time I'd done something that meant something, even though it's still fundamentally just comedy and it's throwaway and it's daft. And a lot of my act is very willfully insincere, and I'm trying to challenge people's, try and make people question everything that they're seeing, but to still have that reaction was really nice. And that's why so in the show at the end I go, by the way, this was pure OCD, in a very cake and eat it, like,
yes,
you guys can go fuck themselves, but here, by the way, it's this.
Yeah.
By the way, I've got my health problems, cheers.
Yeah.
But the reason why I gave it a label, obviously, as I said earlier, because it's a lesser known thing, but I was talking to a friend of a friend a few months before The Fringe last year, and we were talking about something. He's like a director who's talking about, you know, ideas that we might want to work on together. And I was telling him about the show, the concept of the show, and he was tearing up. And I said, are you okay? And he said, no one has ever said that out loud.
Mm-hmm.
I've had that my whole life, and I've never known that it was a thing. And that was when I went, oh, I can't play hard and fast with, well, I've got to be really sensitive. Because initially I was like, no, fuck these guys. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to be it and live it and don't give anything a label. But actually seeing that reaction made me realize that, oh, it could actually be useful for people.
One of the things you said that was quite interesting was when I wrote my book, Cheer Up Love, about depression, I didn't expect people to come up to me and tell me about their depression.
Yeah, and it's a poison challenge,
isn't it? Which sounds really,
really
stupid.
Yeah, no, yeah.
But at book signings, people would come up to me in tears. And you suddenly go, oh, no.
Yeah.
oh no, I'm now people's, I'm their thing.
You're the person that made them
feel connected.
Yeah,
connected.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, I don't have enough time in the world to be everything to all these people. And it's, but also knowing that you've had that effect.
Yeah.
It all started, I did a Radio 4 show about depression. I have never had that kind of reaction in my life. I never had since yeah. we did that show about depression.
Yeah.
And it's an astonishing thing, because the loneliness, I think, sometimes you feel when you have a mental health condition. As soon as, do you know what it's like?
Yeah.
It's like being a youngster in the 80s and seeing Sandy Toksvig on the television and knowing there was another lesbian out there. It's literally yeah. that kind of holy mother of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is somebody else out there who feels the same way.
And you forget how, particularly because, you know, you've written books, you talk about it quite liberally. Mm-hmm. You forget that for a lot of people, it's very hard to talk about it. And also, it's very hard for people to identify what it is. But they know that it's something. There's something wrong and they don't yes. know what it is.
But the other problem is, it's still difficult for me to talk about.
Of course. Yeah, you don't owe anyone anything. You don't owe them.
When I do book festival events, I'm prepared for it. I kind of know the questions. Mm-hmm. But when someone comes up to me afterwards and asks me about something, I can completely lose it.
Yeah, yeah,
because
of course.
These are still painful things to talk about.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, I just went again, Jordan. Oh, this happens a lot, by the way. I'm a crier.
That's fine. Go for it.
I don't even know you, Jordan. And we're in a cupboard and I'm crying. As someone who's full of doubt, comedy.
Yeah.
Why? It's a profession full of doubt.
Oh, it's so full of doubt. But that's what I really like. That's what I've always really enjoyed, is that thrill. I worry that my reasons for getting into it and for remaining in it, if I stripped it right back, are incredibly unhealthy. You know, I worry that I am chemically dependent on a gig going well. I worry that if a gig doesn't go so well and I feel sad, that's dangerous. But I got into it because I was a funny kid. I was a funny kid at school for very archetypally obvious reasons. You know, mm-hmm. it was a great defense when all my friends were going off and getting into relationships, and I. There had to be a point where I'd be like, okay, well, I'm going to have to present a reason why I'm not that doing that. And I just thought I was unattractive. I thought I was absolutely repellent. And so, but it's okay, because I'm the funny guy. I'm the funny one. Or I'm the one that's taking loads of drugs, and I'm the zany one, you know, and that stuff like that. And I worry that that's the origin of it. And now I'm doing it with my life. I don't know if it's healthy. I don't know.
I think my wife, when we got... I wasn't a comedian when I met my wife. I was a corporate lawyer. All the laughs. And I gave up because I really wanted to be a stand-up comedian. I'm not sure why I wanted to be a stand-up comedian. And I remember my wife saying, at a very difficult time, you know, when you're starting out and you're doing lots of gigs and you're getting paid £10 and you're travelling around and it just, everything's awful.
Still do them.
Yeah.
Love them.
And I remember her saying, why do you do this? Am I not enough for you?
Right.
Answer no, love. Sorry. I'd love to say yes, but I require the affirmation of a group of strangers on a Friday night to make me feel worthwhile.
Yeah.
Saws.
Yeah.
I mean, saws. Yeah. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most of us, I think,
well, that's
feel
it.
Like that.
You know, there's the impression of like, there's a sort of tears of a clown, giving something up, being an entertainer, for giving something up for others. I don't care about others. It's for me. It's for me. So I can feel real nice about myself.
There is always, and this is not your pure OCD, almost all stand-up comedians are sociopaths in some way.
Oh, borderline. I mean, everyone's on that.
Borderline
yeah.
or full-blown.
Yeah,
full-blown sociopaths.
Yeah.
Who feel things so deeply.
Yeah.
Yet care so little for others. Yeah. You know, if you're turned down, I didn't get on Mock the Week, cry, 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 no, cry, yeah. cry. It's my mother's funeral, you're coming. I've got a gig, what are you talking about? Yeah. Jeez, of course I'm not coming to your mother's funeral. Do you know what I mean? There's a very odd balance that we are deeply emotional.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet not.
That's really interesting. And I find that very hard. When you're watching stand-ups and they are doing very relatable material, but I know them personally, and I know that they have absolutely not a solitary scrap of empathy in them, and I know that this connection that they are nurturing with the audience of, like, don't we all experience this and stuff? I know it's so agonizingly, violently false, and I find that very hard to watch. What I really like is when someone is truthful, and that can come in literally any form. It's just about feeling that presence, that truth, that humanity. And I think comedy is changing. And I think the sort of traditional observational, very direct stand-up style is becoming less popular, because we want something more than just well-written jokes,
yes,
and well-structured routines. We want to see a person. Because we all feel increasingly detached and alone from one another. And what greater joy to just watch a person be a person on stage.
I think it's... If I watch... I know many great comedians who tell jokes. I don't think I've ever told a joke in my life. I tell a series of rambling stories that eventually come to some form of conclusion. I don't tell jokes, and I find the act of watching jokes for 55 minutes not very interesting.
Oh no!
Whereas when I watch Bridget Christie pretending to be the Black Death with a blanket over her head to four people, my God, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it was extraordinary to watch something like that in front of my eyes.
Because it's someone giving something up for you. It's watching someone sacrifice something, and that can be dignity or their own privacy or something. But there's just they are giving something up for you,
and that is incredibly
lovely to experience, and you just know it when you watch somebody. You know if there are stakes in this, and you know if they are being truthful, and that doesn't necessarily mean telling the truth or saying something that has happened, but you just recognize truth. We all have an intuition for it.
It's one of the reasons why I've never moved away from Glasgow,
mm.
because. The reality of my life is in Glasgow,
mm-hmm.
and I don't live in London, and I don't go to celebrity parties, and mm-hmm. I live in Glasgow and go to my local pub because that is who I am.
Yeah.
And I think if I started telling stories, and I was at the Groucho the other day.
Well, exactly.
That's not me.
This is the risk, isn't it? You know should I say his name? This is the problem with
write it on your hand. Write it on your hand. We'll cut it
there's
out.
There's a certain Ricky Gervais.
So fine. You can say him. That's not a problem.
He's not going to be listening.
Everyone else is slagging him off. It doesn't matter.
Great. All right, let's do this.
Yeah.
But there's something I remember very. I did a series of interviews a few years ago with one with Larry David, one with Christopher Guest, and one with Gary Shandling. The one with Gary Shandling went so badly that he then no longer did any. I don't know if you've seen it. And what I remember so clearly two things that Gary Shandling said to Ricky Gervais. One of them was the moment you think you've got it as an actor, as a performer, as a person, you've lost it. And Ricky Gervais is just nodding along like, like with a sort of sagely understanding. But he doesn't get it. At that point, he's gone. He's gone. You know, it's like fame has corrupted him at that point. He also then says, and he gives Gervais a really long, lingering stare afterwards. He says, you cannot get caught up in the result of your work. That is not who you are. And he holds it, and Gervais just sort of shrugs it off. But it's the most, I think that is Shandling warning him. Do not become part of the thing. Do not live in the thing. Mm-hmm. And no matter how many times you kid yourself into believing that, you're infiltrating that world because you want to send up fame and whatever. It's like, well, you can't be doing that when Ben Stiller's got his arm around you. You know, you are now part of that, and you are now so far removed from the thing that made people like you in the first place.
I know someone who simply wants to be famous.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And to Instagram pictures of them in free stuff. Yeah. I always turn down free stuff. I've never accepted.
Oh, really?
I was offered a mattress. Do you know what I needed a mattress? Well, we didn't need to tweet that I got the mattress.
Oh, no,
and I thought, I don't want to turn into the person who starts tweeting, thanks very much to X, Y, and Z for the mattress.
Exactly, yeah.
Because I hate them.
Yeah.
And if you become the people that you hate, it's not to say you can't change and evolve as a person, but if you actively become the thing you hate, then I hate me.
Yeah, exactly.
And I already don't like myself as it is. I don't need extra excuse to
No matter
hate
how great a night's sleep you're going to get.
Listen, I wish I'd taken it now. I've seen the price of mattresses. This podcast, just before we finish up, is listened to by lots of people.
Mm.
Depressed people, people who know people with depression, just anyone in particular. And I always like to finish, or I'd like to finish, and it doesn't need to be positive. It doesn't mean to be negative. It means almost, you know, that 16, 17-year-old person who you were before you realised what you had and before there was any help. What would you like to say to anyone? I always say at the end of it, don't lose hope.
Yeah.
There is something out there. I'm not going to lie to anyone and say it's not going to take time to find it. But you're not on your own. Literally, almost all of us are living with some form of mental health condition.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would like to say?
I think what I would say to myself at that age and others experiencing that is you're not alone, because we all experience uncertainties and we all experience doubts and we are all broken. And rather than that being a reason to hide away from others, that is the basis on which we should connect.
It's been lovely to connect with a fellow sociopath in a cupboard where I started crying very briefly. And
it was beautiful. Thank you, Susan. Cheers, mate.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you download your podcast from, and then you'll automatically get next week's episode. Next week, I'll be talking to Jessie Cave. Why aren't you in therapy?
Exactly.
Have you been in therapy?
Well, the problem is, I feel like it's dating. I don't have time to date therapists, because isn't it like you find the right one? I don't have time to date and find a therapist. I have to choose one.
Okay. So, to you, the choice is between dating and therapy?
Yeah, I either have sex or I find a therapist.
I'm going to say therapy is more important, Jessie.
I'm going to say...
Therapy is more important. If I'm being honest with you, if you think that's your choice, you need to go to therapy. If you like the show, do leave us a review, as that'll help other people find it too. And if you want to get in touch, then you can email mrsbrightside@bbc.co.uk. And finally, we know this podcast talks about things that might have affected you or someone you know personally. If that's the case and you'd like some further info, head to the Mrs. Brightside page on the BBC website, and we'll put up some links to places you might find useful. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Kalman out.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.